This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Try to put on the show.
It is Danny and Gallant. It's Wednesday. You know what that means. It means we got Michael Bumpus in with us.
Here we go.
This is Coors Light's Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, G, U corner, halfback, flat, on two. Ready, right.
Blue 42 is brought to you by Coors Light. The mountains turn blue at 42 degrees.
Blue 42!
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42! Blue 42!
Bump, how are you now?
Awesome. Good morning, fellas. Good morning.
It's great to have you in. I know it's been a tough couple of days for you. You're a SoCal guy. You're a huge Kobe Bryant fan. What did Kobe mean to you?
Kobe was L.A. You know, I felt like Kobe was a part of me. I named my second son Kobe just because of his mentality and his fierceness, his how articulate he was, how smart he was, how versed he was. He was. I got to watch him for 20 years. He came into the league when I was 11 years old. And for 20 years, I got to watch him. So I've known life with Kobe more than I've known life without Kobe. So it's been crazy. It's been tough. You know, my family feels like we lost a family member. You know, every time I see a montage with him and his daughter, it chokes me up. I have a daughter. You know, I have kids. So I could only imagine what his wife is going through. So L.A. is mourning tough. Talk to my grandmother, talk to my mom, all my relatives. And it's a very sad week in Los Angeles.
What was it about the way he played basketball that resonated so much? Because the connection he has, in my mind, it's greater than the connection LeBron has had. And LeBron's every bit as skilled and accomplished a player, but there was something different about Kobe.
I think with Kobe, it was his focus and his ability to not get rattled or shaken in moments. And then just the way he locked into a game. You know, he got this look on his eye and you knew he was in a different place, a place that not a lot of athletes can get to. You know, I consider myself an elite athlete back in the day, and I thought I was focused and I was a competitor, and I was. But there's some people who can just tap into a part of the brain that a lot of people can't tap into. We call those guys geniuses, right? Like, how does he do that? How does he make that move? How does he figure that out? And he had a genius mind with a blue-collar work ethic, which was crazy. You know, there's a lot of guys who have a lot of talent. Like, he used to get on – him and Shaq and Kobe used to go back and forth because Shaq was a better athlete than Kobe was, but he didn't work as hard. And Kobe knew that. And Kobe challenged people. He didn't care if he wasn't liked. And then you get to see him soften up after, you know, you see the Mamba mentality, the fierceness in him. So to see all of his ups and downs, his smiles and frowns, and to see him get through and persevere was excellent to watch. 20 years in the making. This is a very sad day. 41, way too young.
Our condolences to you, Bump, to everybody. That's how I feel. I'm really sad for obviously his family, yeah, his friends, but also just to his fans and the people he inspired. Question two, Bump. I've been waiting 2 years for Richard Sherman to look slow. I was certain it was going to happen after he came back from the blown Achilles, which, by the way, Kobe came back from as well. I thought, you know what, he's just not going to be able. He's never been the fastest corner, and especially his 40 time. His top-end speed's pretty good. Like, once he gets up to speed, he's able to carry it, but that short-term acceleration, and he still looks just as fast as he's ever looked. In fact, it doesn't look like his play has suffered at all. How's he been able to sustain that level coming back from that injury?
You know, it comes down to his resources. You got to think, Richard Sherman's an elite athlete, made a lot of money. He probably had the best surgeon, and he probably had the best rehab. And then you hit it on the head. He was never really super quick and super fast, so it's not like you're going to see a drastic drop, you know? A lot of guys who are really fast, they drop very quickly in their speed and their quickness. But if a guy who's just kind of long and lanky and never really relied on the speed and relied on the smarts, he's good to go. And you got to think about life expectancy. What, like 150 years ago, the average male lived to, what, 40-something? You know, now we're living to about 75, 80, knock on wood. Same thing in the NFL. Guys are more aware of their bodies and what it takes to stay healthy, and they invest in themselves. So it's a combination, and he's lucky. You got to get lucky sometimes. Sometimes you're just blessed with the ability to keep playing football. So I think he's very conscious of what he puts into his body. He was very conscious of his rehab. I'm sure he had a great surgeon and his mental, man. He's got that Mamba mentality. He's got that mental that says, I'm going to persevere over anything. And then his scheme. Darrell Revis got on him a bit for not playing man-on-man. So what, so be it. He's a cover three zone type corner, and he plays in a scheme that fits his abilities. He's not asked to really stay on a guy's hip for 12, 15, 20 yards. He's asked to flip those hips, keep everything in front, and just react to the football.
He's an incredibly cerebral player, and I imagine as your career wanes on, and as all of a sudden the athleticism that you once had as a young pup starts to leave you, you got to make that your forte. What's the key to doing that as an ex-athlete? Because I imagine once you get to that point where you're essentially, not to compare a guy playing basketball at the Y to the NFL, but when you start resorting to those old man tactics at age 45 at the Y, like tugging on shorts and stuff, that's what you have to get to. For you as an ex-athlete, what is that like?
Yeah, you don't work harder. You work smarter on the field. You learn the tricks of the trade. For a guy like Sherman, it's all route recognition. It's learning how to study film, picking up on guys' tendencies. Whereas when you're a young guy, you're kind of just gung-ho, kamikaze, let's go out there and just bang. Whereas now is, he's been in the league for so many years. There's not too many things that he hasn't seen. And you said it, the tricks of the trade, the pulling on the hip, the giving a little nudge at the top of the route. You know, the 40-year-old at LA Fitness who is consistent, who's going to set the right screen, who's gonna make the right pass, who's going to do the right thing in the perfect situation. And that's what Richard Sherman does. He doesn't compromise himself by making too many mental errors. To flip it, he works super hard in the weight room and in the film room and gets familiar with his opponent to where he's able to anticipate and react to things. And when you're anticipating and reacting, that means the game is slowing down. That means you got a lot of experience. So, hey, man, there's a golden age when it comes to old man sports and stuff. And right now he's in his golden age at that corner spot.
I like that. Question three. That old man golden age, Richard Sherman, is going to have to stop a Chiefs offense that is loaded with speed. And it's loaded with speed, and yet still Tyreek Hill looks like he is playing a different sport than just about everybody with how fast he is, both just running in a straight line, and also when he's in a little bit of space, he's so good at getting out of those tiny, tiny little areas, almost cat-like. What's the best counter that a defense can throw at a wide receiver that has that kind of speed and quickness?
If I'm guarding a Tyreek Hill, I'm trying to disrupt what he wants to do. How do you do that? You get physical at the line of scrimmage. You try to mess up his timing. If he's crossing the field as a linebacker, you get a hand on him. You get a shoulder on him. But if you are aggressive at the line of scrimmage, because of his quickness, you're liable to give up a big play. And also, what can you do? You follow him with a safety. You keep a safety on top. But I heard you talk about it earlier, Paul, but then it opens up someone else. You keep a safety over top. That guy, Kelsey, over there is going to eat as well. So, you know, you try to mess up his timing. You try to get your hands on him. He's a small guy. So if I'm a bigger corner, I'm a safety. If I walk down on him, I want to give him a little jab at the line. Even if you're playing the zone, you can jab him, then boom, drop into your zone. Now you walk him to him the second or third time, you fake a jab and drop into your zone. You got to keep him guessing. Where he makes it up, it's just he's the fastest man in the NFL, and his speed will allow him to make up for some of those things. But it's all about messing up the timing and visually making Patrick Mahomes look at him on the line of scrimmage and say, you know what, he's beat right now. Let me go to my second or third read.
It's interesting, Bump, because he's so fast, and there are a lot of really fast players in the NFL. But watching him, that different level of speed, it's crazy. Paul was asking, kind of, is he the fastest player you've ever seen? DeSean Jackson was pretty fast. I remember thinking that, man, that guy, especially when he was early on in his college career at Cal and then his first run with the Eagles, he was that way. Who are some of the fastest guys you've ever seen?
Fastest guys I've ever seen. DeSean is one of them. DeSean had that long stride fast. You know, Tyreek Hill has that choppy, quick fast. Like, his burst is crazy. People, T.O., man. I used to see T.O. when he opened up, it was like he was galloping. It was like he was thoroughbred at the Kentucky Derby, just galloping down the field. I paid attention more to the quick guys, the guys with a little burst and stuff. So I look at like the Wes Welkers and stuff. And even back in the day, the Bobby Ingrams. But that straight line speed, what was that returner for the Baltimore Ravens? Reward number 12.
Jacoby Jones.
Jacoby Jones has some nice straight line speed.
He's a funny guy.
But you know what? Everyone's fast in the league, Danny. It's like if you're playing a receiver, you're probably running a 4.4. Most of you guys run a 4.3s these days. This is a different level of speed out there.
I like that you brought up the timing thing, because that is a really underrated element of playing the position, wide receiver. If someone is going to disrupt you at all, like imagine you're supposed to get off the line of scrimmage, and then all of a sudden someone's bumped you and the ball's coming your way. It's that easy to disrupt someone, but yeah, but someone like Tyreek Hill, I really don't know how you do it, because if you whiff, you're going to whiff badly.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's a high-risk type play. You go down to press this dude. If he gets by you, it's a wrap. And, you know, I think if you do decide to play zone, which I expect the 49ers to do mostly against these guys, is when he's crossing the field, just get a body in front of him. Don't give him a straight line. Make him bend his routes a little bit. You know, then after that, it's just rally to the football. And don't dive. You gotta rally to the football, get 11 hats on him, and just break down. Like, where a lot of guys mess up, they go for the big hit. You know, that's the curse of being a smaller guy. Everybody wants the big hit on the small guy. No one wants to have the big hit on a Henry, but on a Tyreek Hill, they're going to come down and try to smash him, and that will get them in trouble because he'll take a step back, take a step to the left, and now you got your face mask in the dirt looking up and asking what happened.
That is Blue 42. Michael Bumpus is in with us today. He'll be in for the next hour. Paul was asking the question earlier in the show about looking at Tyreek Hill and the opportunities that he's made, and it's not like any NFL team is like, I don't know if we could really use speed. Someone like that, like, I could take it or leave it.
We want plotters.
Yeah, but the idea of making that a priority, how much would Seattle benefit from having someone who comes in with top-end speed, not Tyreek Hill speed, but top-end speed? Is that something that their offense would really benefit from?
I think they could benefit from it, but the question is, how would they use it? You know, because when you have a guy like a Tyreek Hill, a guy with that top-end speed, you run those end arounds, you run those short crossing patterns. You want him to get the ball with a full head of steam, and there aren't too many plays in this offense to where receivers get the ball with a full head of steam. It's either, okay, deep ball, go or a post, or you're sitting in a zone. You haven't really seen this offense do things like the Kansas City Chiefs do, you know? So they would have to get creative. Will it help? Definitely. You always want to add speed to your offense. It gets the defense on their heels, but it's how are you going to use that? Who's the fastest guy on the offense right now for
straight line? Wouldn't it be DK
it's
Metcalf?
DK, right? It's DK. But DK's kind of speed is different than a Tyreek kind of speed. A DK speed is after 20, 30 yards, okay, now he's going. Now he's moving. You know, he's like a Cadillac. You know what I mean? It takes a while to get going, but once that thing is going, it's going, it's floating, it's moving. Tyreek Hill is more of like a Porsche, you know? From 0 to 60, it's crazy. So you can always benefit from it. My concern would be, how would they use it?
I think that that's the best part about it, is that they can use it. Because I would like to see them try to do some stuff with DK Metcalf, but from all the comparisons to a battleship that we've heard made with DK Metcalf, that he just is not as quick at turning, I could see maybe some hesitation there. But maybe I'm wrong on this, Bump. I've heard this offense described as rather simplistic. Part of that makes me actually excited about the idea of bringing in a young wide receiver. And now maybe it is a much more difficult system to pick up than I'm intimating, especially with how we know DK Metcalf's a really hard worker. But this offense could definitely use something like that, where they're doing different things.
Yeah, and I think they could. And people talking about offenses being like simplistic or difficult, the difficulty in an offense is just the language. Because you listen to a Gruden call a play, man, Tris Red X play, zebra line X. I mean, it's a run-on sentence. You know what I mean? And then you listen to an offense, and then it's simple. So it's all about teaching the guys the language of the offense. The routes and combinations itself, you're not going to wow a football player and say, man, I've never seen a concept like this. The last time I saw a concept that I was like, man, I haven't seen that, was actually this year when the Packers ran a fake crossing route. They had two receivers in a 2x2 formation, had two receivers to the left. They pretended like they were going to overlap and cross each other, but they faked it and dispersed out. So that was nice. But before then, I'm like, there's not too many route combinations that I haven't seen before and that most guys haven't seen before. So it's all about getting them acclimated. But you can definitely use speed, man. Speed kills. I don't care. I mean, that's why, guys, I played with guys who didn't touch the field at Washington State. Ran a 4.3, got invited to a camp. Speed kills. People are always looking for the next fastest thing.
Yeah. As we've talked about this, I've kind of found myself cycling through the history since John and Pete have been here, kind of the past 10 years of players that they looked at. I know in the 2013 draft, they were looking at Tavon Austin. At least I think they were looking at Tavon Austin. He was a kick returner out of West Virginia. He blew up the combine. And after that, Seattle traded its first round pick as part of the deal for Percy Harvin. Now, I don't know this. I think part of that was they were kind of hoping maybe Austin would slide to them. They were hoping that maybe they would get him. And once that happened, they're like, well, there's no chance we're going to get him. If we're going to get speed, we're going to have to do it. And so they pursued Percy Harvin. Javid Best, the running back from Cal, who was also very speedy. His NFL career ended up being shortened by concussions. I know that was someone that was very interesting to him. Harvin, and for all the times that we've talked about this year about their difficulty of speed on the perimeter, the Seahawks were actually one of the first teams to start using the fly sweep. Like in this most recent phase of this, that was something they were going to use with Percy Harvin. And they talked about using it the year they won the Super Bowl. He was hurt for most of the year. They ended up using it some in the five or six games that he played with Seattle before he ended up deciding he didn't want to finish the game against Dallas and getting traded and the whole mess that was. So I feel like they've consistently, it's not like they've been sort of, we're an old fashioned offense. They've always wanted speed. And I've loved Pete's conversation when he's been asked about sort of the difference in value of a receiver like AJ Green, where he's like, the guy makes touchdowns. Like that's the difference, is a possession receiver is valuable at moving the ball down the field, but the guy who can score a touchdown from 60 yards out that you have to worry about, that is something else. And that's a guy, AJ Green's going to be a free agent. Does anybody have interest in him? I love AJ Green, but he's older and he's definitely was hobbled by injuries. That idea, I expect Seattle to look for speed. Where they find it, I think, will be an interesting question.
Yeah, and if the one thing the Hawks don't do is spend a lot of money, they just don't do it. I mean, they have in the past, obviously, with your Russell Wilson, your Bobby Wagner, whatnot, but they're not the type of franchise to go out and just spend a lot of money on an AJ Green. And at this point, I think they should. I mean, it's go time right now. Russell, he's 30 years old. You know, he's got about three or four more, I think, really elite years, and probably longer than that. But you want to, you know, people talk about wasting his prime. I don't think they're wasting his prime, but he's definitely in it now. And you got to break the bank for him. It's time to go. Bobby's not getting any younger. You got JD Clowney over there. You finally have some safeties. You have some youth within this organization with the DK and the Bartons and whatnot. It's time to go now. And if they feel they're missing somebody with speed, go get your speed. Go get your AJ. Go get a star-studded roster and roll the dice and see what happens.
If you're in AJ Green's shoes, you've played with one organization for the entirety of your career. It's not a very well-run one. How are you approaching this free agency? And I'm not saying to say what you think he's thinking. If you're in his shoes and you're saying, I could get a big-time payday that I've always felt I've deserved, or I could play for a contender, for a guy who's getting up there in age and dealing with injuries, how would you put yourself in that situation, and how would you act in that situation?
If I'm in that situation, one, who's bringing the most money to the table? Mm-hmm. You know,
so that's number one. Okay,
it is what it is, and I think you start there, and then you see who's out there, what your value is, what your worth is, and then you look at the teams who are offering this money. Do I want to go to Cleveland? Do I want to go here? Do I want to go there? I think there are steps to this. I think initially, if you have a good agent, you got good people around you, you're going to like, look, AJ, you've been one of the best receivers in the league for X amount of years. You need to get your money. And then you see what's out there, and now you're like, okay, is going to Buffalo worth sacrificing not ever getting a ring?
It's so cold.
You know? So, and then maybe you find your middle point, you know? But with me, if I'm him, I'm later in my career, you got to go chase the bag. I mean, it is what it is. You got to take care of your family. You got to take care of your kids. You got to make sure everybody's good to go. Start there, and then you start to reevaluate and see what's really important. Is it worth taking a $4 or $5 million cut to go chase a ring, or are you content with your career and yourself? You're like, you know what? I'm going to go down as one of the greats. I'm just going to go get this money.
I would also have like a questionnaire that I would have a potential receiver fill out, especially someone like AJ Green. And the most important question on there, will you complain if you don't catch more than 40 passes? Like, and not saying that that's the expectation, but I just want to know if you're going to complain if you don't catch more than 40 passes, because that's in the overall pantheon of things. Like, that's a possibility, is that you'll be an effective player in this offense. And you might not even have the most catches, but are you going to complain? Because that's got to be on the table, that you can't complain if you're going to get 40 catches.
And that's got to be an insulting thing to also even just broach the idea of with a veteran wide receiver who's accomplished a lot. And as someone who used to cover the Houston Texans, that's what Bill O'Brien did with Andre Johnson when they had a free agency meeting. And Rick Smith, the general manager of the Texans, they basically were like, we view you as a 40-catch-a-year kind of guy. Andre did not take it very well, though he only had about 40 catches with the Colts the next year.
Well, if I'm Andre and I'm in Houston, yeah, I'm mad at that, you know, because what are your chances of really winning the Super Bowl up there? Now, if you come over to Seattle and Pete and Snyder are honest and transparent with you, you're like, look, you're only going to catch X amount of footballs, but we have a legit chance to go win a Super Bowl. It's all about wants and needs at this point. And at this point of AJ's career, I mean, he's earned the right to make some demands. This is what I want. I've proven myself in this league. I'm not a guy who's coming off the street who you have no expectations for. Who's not proven. He's a proven guy. So, He's all right. He can have some demands. He can go to where he sees fit. He's going to want 60 to 70 catches a year. But do you want the catches? Do you want the bag? Or do you want a ring?
Yeah, and I think that question, because it's not about whether the player's right or wrong to think that. He needs to know what's happening. Doug Baldwin, I will give a ton of credit to anytime. That guy never complained about the volume of workload. There were times that he didn't. He resented the fact that people didn't recognize that receivers in this offense aren't going to catch as many passes. There were times that made him mad, but he never complained about the opportunities. And I think that's hard for a receiver. I think that's really hard for a receiver. And if the only way that you can establish that is by getting it out of the way early of saying, hey, look, this is going to be different than you're used to. And we understand if you're not into it, but you just got to know the score. This is how it's going to be. You can't do the bait and switch. You can't recruit him in and then once you get him there say, ha ha, it's going to be a little different than you thought, because then you're going to get guys that are going to get mad. And that tends to be the, no offense, Bump, but the receivers tend to be the squeakiest wheels.
Can't deny it. Yes, we are. Yes, we are. I'm like, well, how did it get to that? It's supposed to be the quarterback, right? It's supposed to be the quarterback. But for some reason, us receivers, man, we're the prettiest and the loudest. And I just don't get it. Not my brand of receiver, but it's definitely out there. And maybe it's because, you know what? It's because we're the most marketable. That's what it is.
Look at that.
We're the most marketable.
Here it comes.
You know?
I think it's the most marketable. You're also the one, and Wyman said this before, you're the one that depends on the offensive line has to block, the center has to snap the ball, the quarterback has to see you. For you to get a chance to do your job, four other things have to go right first. So it can be difficult. And the times when you don't get those opportunities when you should, it's frustrating. You want a chance to show your worth.
Yes, it is. I want to remind people, in a football game, all right, say in an average game, receiver catches 6 or 7 footballs. There are 60 to 70 offensive plays. And a lot of those times, a receiver lines up, he looks at the coverage, he knows the plays, and he knows he's not getting this football. But I have to run this route as hard as I can because I'm going to get somebody else open. I'm going to affect the defense a certain way. So there are a lot of times where receivers are running 40, 50 yards down the field. They don't get the ball. They're frustrated. They know they're not getting the ball, and they run back to huddle. So, I mean, they're really selfish. So when they get a time to shine, folks,
hey,
let the receivers shine just a little bit.
Yeah, there we go. See, let's be honest. They're speaking from a little personal experience right there.
Yeah, it's true, man. I remember being at practice, and my boy Alex Brink, he'd be like, come on, hustle, let's go. I'm like, Brink, you're taking 5 steps, throwing the ball, and no one is touching you. Meanwhile, I'm running 60 yards down the field. Guys are trying to take my head off at practice. It's just a little different. So have a little sympathy and let me walk back to this huddle and catch my breath, because I'm just going to run 50 yards again and not get the ball.
Andy Reid's firing from Philadelphia after the 2012 season was the rarest of things. It's a divorce that both sides won. We'll explain next here. It's Danny and Gallant with Michael Bumpus.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
It is Danny and Gallant. Our playoff coverage is brought to you by Washington Farm Bureau Healthcare. And divorce is often ugly, always painful, in my experience. Never, ever easy. And in Andy Reid's separation from the Philadelphia Eagles, I think it's that rarest of things where both sides came out better for it. The Eagles have won a Super Bowl. The Chiefs are back in the Super Bowl. He'd been a coach there for a long time, 1999 through 2012 season. He'd taken them to, 4 straight NFC Championship games. They got into the Super Bowl, And they decided to move on. They turned the page. And I think both sides are better off for it.
We're in a spot now where Andy Reid's back in the Super Bowl 15 years later. The Eagles seem to be competently run, though I do wonder if maybe they look at Andy Reid right now. They compare him to Doug Peterson without Frank Reich, and maybe they think, oh, Andy was pretty
good. They won a Super Bowl, though. They can't complain, right? They won a Super Bowl.
It's Philadelphia. You
Once you win a Super
them.
Bowl, you can't complain for 5 years.
That's not Philadelphia, though, which is funny because they had never won a Super Bowl. It's a weird situation, I think, unfolding there. How do you feel about this bump? Danny and I have touched on this before. I think that there was like an awkward phase where Philadelphia clearly was getting essentially dragged through the mud in the midst of this divorce, especially during the Chip Kelly era. But they have been able to bounce back. Where with Andy Reid, I mean, what he has done in Kansas City, first with Alex Smith and now with Patrick Mahomes, it's really been impressive what he has turned this team into.
It just shows that he's a great coach. You know, he's an offensive mind. You know, if you are a receiver, if you're anybody with some type of speed, you want to play for an Andy Reid. And it's crazy to see him evolve. I don't even know if he evolved or he just adjusts to his personnel, you know. To go from the 99 to 2012 to now, the game looks a lot different. It's a lot faster, a little more gimmicky, shifts, motions, all this stuff. Tight ends are more athletic now. You're able to use your players differently. So to see his adjustments through his career is amazing. Like, I think the 49ers are going to win the Super Bowl, but if the Chiefs win, I'm not mad because of Andy Reid, because he's been to the four conference championships, lost to the Patriots in a Super Bowl with T.O. coming off a broken leg. And you just see, and then I love where he is in his life right now. He seems so happy. You're watching him during these press conferences. I've never seen him talk and smile this much. So it's kind of like, man, seeing your uncle, man, just do something great. You're like, man, you know what, Unc, if you get this win, I'm not mad at you. But I just appreciate him as a coach and love his versatility.
He seems like a coach that would be very fun to play for. I don't know if you've played with any teammates that maybe had stints with Andy Reid in Philadelphia or in any other spot maybe earlier in their career, but it just seems like he's the most laid-back, easygoing coach. Really suits the Hawaiian shirts as well.
Yeah, I've had, I believe, man, did Brandon Gibson play for Philly when Andy Reid was there, Jess?
Brandon Gibson?
Was B-Gib there when Andy Reid was there?
Oh, man, you're really testing me on my Wazoo knowledge here. I'll look it up.
I'm gonna have to ask B-Gib. If I did have a teammate, it'd be Brandon Gibson. I believe he was drafted in like 2009, 2010, so he may have been there.
When you see what Andy Reid's done, he came from the sort of the quintessential Mike Holmgren school of offense, and it does seem like he has evolved. And I give Kansas City a lot of credit, because one of the toughest things to do in sports is to take a successful situation and decide, okay, we can still be better. And that's what they did with Alex Smith. And Alex Smith, they were a pretty good team. And he decided that, you know what, we're going to turn the page because we think Mahomes is better. And Mahomes is something, a whole different caliber of quarterback. And it seems that Andy Reid has adjusted his system to having Patrick Mahomes. And I honestly feel we've entered a new era of football where it's not about the coach's system anymore. It's much more about how can the coach accentuate the talents of the quarterback he has, rather than, hey, this guy's got to get in here and run my system. He's got to run and do what I do, kind of that Mike Holmgren style, which was extremely effective, and I don't want to knock it, but we've gotten to a new spot where it's not about finding the quarterback to fit the system. It's about molding your system to accentuate the strengths of the quarterback.
Yeah, and I love that, man. I mean, old school football is, you do it my way. This is how it's done here. This is the Patriot way. This is how we do things around here. Whereas now it's like, okay, I have my philosophy. I have what I think a good player is, and I have a system that works. But if I have a certain type of talent, I'm going to tweak it. And I think that's the evolution of head football coaches. They're becoming more flexible and more interactive with their players. They understand what type of player they have. And for Andy Reid to send an Alex Smith, who was playing good football, to start a Patrick Mahomes, that means he saw something. He saw something in practice. He saw something in the preseason. And he wasn't afraid to make the move. He wasn't afraid to hurt feelings. So I appreciate that as well. Whenever you're a leader when you got to make tough decisions, you're not going to make everybody happy. You're going to make some decisions that people frown upon. Like, man, what the heck is he doing? Alex Smith is playing good ball right now. But he saw something and he made the move and he wasn't afraid to make the move. And then he put all these weapons around him, man. The Chiefs have to be the fastest football team in the NFL, one of the fastest teams I've ever seen.
There's no one better to, I think, work with all those pieces. He's one of the best offensive coaches in NFL history. He's one of the best in my lifetime covering the league. And I feel bad for him. And, Danny, you're raising your hand. I feel bad for him. The game management side of it always gets brought up first as opposed to the things that he's done. Think about the quarterbacks that he has gotten the most out of. Donovan McNabb, a guy who was coming out of, what, like a triple option system essentially at Syracuse? He got the most out of Michael Vick as a quarterback that I think anyone was able to. Michael Vick was a dynamic talent in Atlanta. He goes to Philadelphia. He was a borderline MVP in 2010. Then he goes to Alex Smith, and he helps Alex Smith be pretty competent.
Let's not get carried. I mean, we're talking about Alex Smith was a number one overall pick who got to the playoffs and won playoff games with the 49ers. Michael Vick was a number one overall pick who was, at a point in time, the most talented player in the league. And Donovan McNabb was a top five pick.
That's fair.
So it's not like he's made the most out of chopped liver. There's an asterisk hanging around Andy Reid's neck of that idea, the best coach, is that he hasn't won a Super Bowl. He hasn't won a Super Bowl. I think he's got the most on the line of anybody in this game. You can look at it and say, yeah, he'll get back because Mahomes is that good. Maybe. But his legacy is going to be incomplete. For him to take a next step up to be mentioned among the great coaches in the NFL, he needs to win a Super Bowl. He's gotten there once and lost in the NFC Championship game three times. That's a lot weighing on him.
Head coaches and quarterbacks are connected, right? The relationship between a head coach and a quarterback is essential to a football team. Yet, quarterbacks who haven't won Super Bowls are considered great and get into the Hall of Fame. So is it unfair to say Andy Reid is not a great because he hasn't won a Super Bowl? I mean, he has had number one picks. He's had talented teams. He's won a lot of football games. So it's just weird because I get it where people can be like, well, he hasn't won a Super Bowl. He's not a great. But then you look at his offense, you're like, well, Dan Marino was great. He got into the Hall of Fame. So that's a tricky thing, you know, because I think he's Hall of Fame caliber type of coach. Does he really need a Super Bowl to secure his spot in the Hall of Fame?
I think he does, and this would be the reason why. Right now, he's kind of a pass-happier version of Marty Schottenheimer, and Marty Schottenheimer is a great all-time coach in this league. But Marty Schottenheimer's reputation, and I don't think it's unearned, was he's a guy that can get you 9-7, 10-6, 11-5 every single year. But he's not the guy that you necessarily think is going to be the one that takes his team to that next level, that he'll make you competitive year in and year out, and that he's going to eliminate some of the valleys that might otherwise be there for a lesser coach, but he's also going to not have some of the same peaks that another coach could get you to. And that's kind of how I feel about Andy Reid right now, that even in the years where they've had incredible regular season success, there's only once that he's even gotten to the Super Bowl.
And I think for the Chiefs of late, I think their biggest problem has been slow starts. And for those who look at Andy Reid and criticize his game management, that used to be something that no one ever criticized. People used to say, oh, he would script the game out about as good as you possibly can at the very beginning. It's funny because it seems to have changed. Like, it's almost flipped on its head. AFC Championship game last year, the Chiefs started slow against the Tennessee Titans. In the AFC Championship game, they started slow. Against the Texans, they started slow. There's something about this. And that, I think, is going to be the biggest key for Andy Reid and company if he wants to change the way that people think of him. But I'm with Danny. I do think you got to win that Super Bowl to get in the Hall of Fame, which is becoming a very, I hate to say, easy to get into club, but a lot of guys are getting in.
And, Michael, now I feel like I'm a jerk grader because Andy Reid is really accomplished, and here I am yanking up the standards on him. But, yeah, I'm going to be ruthless and uncompromising when it comes to it. It's Danny and Gallant. We've got Michael Bumpus in here. It's a blast to have him in on these days. We're going to get back to that conversation we started with about which ex-Seahawk that you're most excited or has sort of resonated with you the most. And that'll continue here on Danny and Gallant.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
We've also got Michael Bumpus in the house, former NFL wide receiver, high school head coach back in the day, not too long ago.
Back in the day.
Back in the day, indeed. Bump, what do you think when you hear someone in the world of sports that speaks in the third person?
I think that they are really feeling themselves right now. And I believe I know who you're talking about. And you know what? If I was in Miami right now and I was playing the NFL, I don't think I was speaking in third person, but I'd really be feeling myself, though.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Clark.
I don't compare myself to no other defensive end in the league. I feel like my skill set is unique, especially you talk about Frank Clark. When I'm healthy, I don't feel like it's a lot of defensive ends who can compete with me or play football at the level I play at. I play at an extremely high and aggressive level, where I don't tolerate a lot of stuff that offensive players do. And, you know, I'm sure he's going to block and do all those good things and make some good catches and stuff. But at the end of the day, Frank Clark is going to be on the field and they have to see me. So,
Frank Clark, is that his teammate?
If you guys were counting at home, that is 7 I's, 3 me's, and 2 Frank Clark's.
The best part is that I don't tolerate a lot of things that offenses try to do. I'm not tolerating any sweeps today. Do not try a draw on me because I'm not tolerating that today.
Danny, do you remember that movie Eddie with Whoopi Goldberg?
Yes.
Stacey Patton. Reminds me of Stacey Patton.
Yeah.
Stacey Patton, third person. Yep.
Yes.
There you go.
Stacey Pat. Frank Clark's not going to tolerate a lot of the things that offenses will try to do to Frank Clark.
Did you have any teammates that had that habit?
Nah, heck no. At least I didn't know about it.
I feel like that would be policed very well in a locker room, but I don't think anyone's doing any policing in a locker room and keeping Frank Clark in check right now. He is definitely, as you said, Bumpin, feeling himself. Mode.
Yeah, he's feeling himself, man. He leaves the Hawks, had a good year, goes to Kansas City, has a decent year, came on in the playoffs, and then, you know, he's feeling himself. I'm not mad because I enjoy the week leading up to the Super Bowl because you really get to see guys' true personalities. Like, guys are on full display. So now we know, man, this is Frank Clark, and it works for him. So there you go, Frank Clark. Do your thing. I ain't mad at you.
It does work for him. I'm going to say that watching how this is unfolded, though, if I'm wondering whether or not Seattle made the right decision to let go of Richard Sherman, which I think is a question. It's a fair one. I think Seattle did. But I kind of feel more strongly that Seattle made the right decision in trading Frank Clark. He's a really good player. I think between this and kind of watching some of the reaction afterward and hearing that he's calling Dee Ford lining up offsides last year, a dumb play, like those sort of things, that's headed in a direction where you're setting yourself up for a fall. Like, there's sort of what the pride goeth before the fall. Like, I see a little bit of that sort of walking with your chest out and, hey, this vindication. Look, he's got the right to feel that way, but watching it, I'm kind of like, yeah, you know what? I think Seattle might have made the right decision in saying we're not going to invest long-term $22 million a year in this guy.
We talk about the Seahawks as if they broke up with Frank Clark. Danny, I hear that. I hear someone that maybe wants to see Frank Clark trip in the Super Bowl. Am I wrong?
No, it's not that. It's that I think that he is becoming a little too full of himself, and I think that tends to be some. Look, I think that sets you up for a fall. I do. I think that when you start thinking that there's not a lot of things that I'm going to tolerate on defense from other offenses, okay, they get paid too, and it's a humbling game. Like, it will come back and bite you. And when you've got a guy that thinks he's figured it all out or feels that he's arrived, I've generally seen that there's an expiration date on that, and it looks ugly when it starts failing.
All this third person and his whole approach right now, it's okay because they're winning. Yes. What's going to happen when they're 7-9 and things aren't going well and he's speaking out, he's talking about his teammates? It's going to be a little different. All is well when you're winning. It's all high fives and hugs and, like, we're here, we made it. But you have one bad season, one bad experience, and now all that talk is going to be perceived a different way, and guys on his team aren't going
to
like him.
It does. It's not that a guy that acts that way can't adjust to it and can't take losses, because when you do get knocked on your butt, there's a different process for coping with that. And it doesn't mean you can't get back up and you can't regroup yourselves. And I'm not saying that someone who acts like this can't respond to adversity or to defeats or to what happens when you're not on top. But generally, as a general trend, people who act like this when they're winning, they don't tend to take losing very well, and usually, in my experience, tend to point the finger at other people rather than say, maybe I'm not as good as I said I was. Like, they tend to look at it and say, well, you can't come and talk to me about that because I'm doing my job. You got to talk to some of these other guys. That's the behavior that I see that tends to correlate with each other.
It could. Here's the thing. It doesn't look like Kansas City's headed for any drop-off anytime soon with Patrick Mahomes, with all those players on offense. I know that things can change with a Super Bowl loss dramatically, and we saw it with the Rams this past season, but I do think that they're set up pretty well. The other guy they broke up with, Richard Sherman. Richard Sherman, I thought, was absolutely delightful in this this exchange where he said he wanted Jim Harbaugh out of the league.
What did that do for me in this? Oh, honestly, I wanted to put him out of the league. And once I got that done, I mean, I got no animosity towards the 49ers or any organization. You know what I mean? Once I became a free agent, every team was available for me to go. I had conversations. I felt like this was the best fit. I felt like this was the place I could go and we could win. And it's worked out well.
He wanted him out of the league, Bob. Once he got him out of the league, then he was free to go to the 49ers.
Yeah, right. Let Jim be there. They toss the right amount at him. You're going to the 49ers. But, hey, that's Sherman. He's so precise with what he said. It's so calculated. Like, he knows what he's doing, man. He's not just freestyling out here. Sherm's a smart dude.
I'm endlessly entertained by that.
I'm happy that he's in this because we get to see more of him, too. Yeah. And there's another exchange, and I don't think we have time for it, where Richard Sherman was at media night and he was discussing basically like a breakup with Seattle. Yeah. A Seattle Seahawks fan came up to him and asked him about it, and he played along with it. I miss the guy.
We can play a little bit of it. Okay. Let's just give him a little bit.
I also want to say this. I'm a huge Seahawks fan. I know I messed up, okay? I still care about you. And I know I made some mistakes.
Okay.
And if you give me another chance, and if you just think about coming back, I promise I'll treat you right. Yeah. I just want you to think about that, okay?
I really appreciate that, and I'm so thankful for the time we had. You know, it was such an incredible relationship. It had its ups and it's had its downs. And right now, you know, the relationship I'm in, I'm so happy and I'm so thankful for the people I have with me. And they came to me at a time when I was really down and out, and they didn't give up on me.
Who's won the breakup more, Frank Clark or Richard Sherman?
Sherm all day.
Yeah, Sherm.
Pro bowler, playing at a high level. I mean, he's back in his zone. He's the Sherm that everyone knows and loves. It's Sherman all day.
Yeah, it's Sherman. Sherman's the one that I'm kind of worried about him winning the breakup. I feel like he's done really well for himself. He's in a great spot. Frank Clark, I don't begrudge him this success, and I kind of think like, yeah, that's going to bite you in the butt before it's all said and done.
Michael Bumpus, we love it whenever you come in on a Wednesday for a full hour. This was a whole lot of fun, and we can't wait to see you later on in the week.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me. See you Friday.
See you on Friday. He is Michael Bumpus, Danny O'Neill, and Paul Gallant. It's Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle. We're very familiar with a guy who, per me, is perhaps the most disrespected player in this year's Super Bowl.
We're going to talk about disrespect?
Yes, we're about to talk about
I can't wait to disrespect someone.
Disrespect. It's coming up next. Has he changed our minds? 710 ESPN Seattle.